Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankford, wishing you a happy new year and welcoming you to the January 13th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that has been coming your way on the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday since January 2001. How much the world has changed since then. In that January, the Pearl Harbor-like event hoped for by the neocon signatories to the Project for New American Century, or PNAC, in 1997, that would be the catalyst for U.S. war to depose Saddam Hussein and redraw the map of the Middle East was still 9 months away. With the election of George W. Bush, it should be remembered that three key members of PNAC, Douglas Feith, Richard Perle, and David Wormser, who 2 years earlier had proposed such a plan for Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu, were ushered into important positions in the White House and the Pentagon. From there, they manufactured the false evidence that was used to justify an invasion, an occupation that has destabilized the entire region and has produced not enduring freedom, as the operations in Afghanistan and Iraq were first labeled, but endless war. A major player in that endless war has been Saudi Arabia. Apart from being a major oil supplier, it was a key component of Washington's efforts to maintain global hegemony during the Cold War, from funding what became al-Qaeda and then the Taliban in Afghanistan to supporting the Contras in Nicaragua. Soon it became the major foreign purchaser of U.S. weaponry, a not insignificant source of the arms industry's enormous profits. Now, with a new king on the throne and believing its regional position threatened by Shia Iran, the Saudis have moved from the shadows to not only finance and arm fundamentalist opponents of the Syrian government of Bashar Assad, an ally of Iran, but have been conducting a bloody, aggressive bombing campaign on neighboring Yemen with Washington's support, a war whose casualties have been ignored or underreported in the U.S. media. Most recently, the Saudi monarchy, the recognized leadership of Sunni Islam, was in the headlines when it elected to execute by public beheading a prominent Shia cleric, Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, along with 46 other Saudis who were accused of being members of al-Qaeda. Since the American public has come to associate the act of beheading one's enemies as emblematic of ISIS or ISIL's barbarism, our media, including Democracy Now!, chose not to mention how the Sheikh and the 46 others met their death. To discuss the significance of that and the larger picture of Saudi activities in the region, I'll be speaking at 20 minutes past the hour with Hassan Hafida, a Middle East scholar pursuing his doctorate at the University of Leeds in the British Midlands. Again, that will be 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned. Until then, let's look at some other things that have been happening since my last program 3 weeks ago that might have skipped your attention. The first was a report in the Wall Street Journal that the NSA had been monitoring the phone conversations of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu during the period that he was brazenly attempting to sabotage the deal between the U.S. and the other four members of the U.N. Security Council plus Germany to curtail Iran's nuclear enrichment program. Not surprisingly, some of these conversations were with members of Congress and the heads of major Jewish organizations, which were also engaged in public lobbying against the agreement. According to the article, it became apparent to the White House that Israeli intelligence had installed malware in the computers where U.S. negotiators were staying during the negotiations in Switzerland, and that they intercepted highly sensitive inside information on the talks and leaked it. Did they pass it on to members of Congress opposed to the Iran deal? The Wall Street Journal asked. Well, answering it was clearly a matter of national security. As the journal reports, quote, stepped up NSA eavesdropping revealed to the White House how Mr. Netanyahu and his advisors had leaked details of the U.S.-Iran negotiations learned through Israeli spying operations to undermine the talks, coordinated talking points with Jewish American groups against the deal, and asked undecided lawmakers what it would take to win their votes, according to current and former officials familiar with the intercepts, end quote. Legislation authorizes the NSA to collect information if its primary purpose is to discover the activities of foreign agents in the United States. As could have been expected, Israel's friends in the media, Republicans in Congress, and some of the presidential candidates rushed to condemn the White House for spying on Congress as well as on a friendly ally. They obviously hoped by their bluster to disguise the fact that what the NSA was doing was entirely within the law and what members of Congress and the Jewish organizational leaders were doing was not. One shouldn't have needed this incident to understand that Israeli government officials and Americans acting under their orders, whether members of Congress or private citizens, qualify as quote-unquote foreign agents. When members of Congress do so, however, the problem becomes or should be considered far more serious. Given past history, we have learned that when it comes to serving the interest of Israel, our legislators have nothing to worry about. In this case, their names are redacted from the article. U.S. intelligence officials are concerned, however, about Israel spying, despite their Tel Aviv counterpart's straight-faced denial that following the arrest and conviction of Jonathan Pollard, Israel's spying on the U.S. had ceased. During congressional hearings in 2014 over whether Israel should be accepted in the visa waiver program, U.S. intelligence officials were adamant against allowing Israelis unrestricted access to our shores. Jeff Stein, writing in Newsweek at the time under the telling headline, quote, "Israel won't stop spying on the U.S., end quote, wrote that, quote, "U.S. intelligence officials are saying, albeit very quietly, behind closed doors on Capitol Hill, that our Israeli friends have gone too far with their spying operations here. That Jerusalem's effort to steal U.S. secrets under the cover of trade missions and joint defense technology contracts have, quote unquote, crossed red lines. Israel's espionage activities in America are unrivaled and unseemly," wrote Jeff Stein. U.S. counterspies have told members of the House Judiciary and Foreign Affairs Committees that Israel's spying goes far beyond activities by other close allies. A congressional staffer familiar with the briefing, Stein said, called the testimony, quote, "very sobering, alarming, even terrifying," end quote. That was 2 years ago, and apparently nothing has changed. By coincidence, perhaps just 2 days after the Wall Street Journal story appeared describing the spying on Netanyahu, PBS's Frontline produced a two-hour documentary entitled Netanyahu at War. While making him out as the most hardline prime minister in Israel's history, PBS nevertheless presented him in heroic terms as a defender of the Jewish people. By selective editing and choice of talking heads, it portrayed Obama as having the primary responsibility for the hostility between the two men. It supposedly stemmed from Obama's decision on the advice of his staff not to stop off in Israel in 2009 after his historic speech in Cairo expressing America's friendship with the Muslim world, a message that 7 years later appears ludicrous. The most telling footage, however, in the film, which the filmmakers could not avoid using, was that of Netanyahu as a rabble-rouser, stirring the hatred of the Jewish settlers and their supporters against Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. This is in the 90s, for having signed the Oslo Agreement, getting them to believe incorrectly that it meant giving up land that they believed God intended for the Jews. When posters appeared showing Rabin wearing a Nazi uniform or a Palestinian keffiyeh, Netanyahu made no move to condemn it. The footage of a rally of thousands of Israelis screaming for Rabin's head was frightening to watch, as are the videos today of young Jewish settlers celebrating the burning to death of a Palestinian baby. What was ignored in the two-hour special was that under Obama, Israel continued to receive Washington's protection in the UN and international forums, and that Israel received more weapons from the United States than under any previous president. One doesn't need to see the videos to know that what harm U.S. weapons have caused and continue to cause in the Middle East and not just in Israel. The recent surge in U.S. arms transfers to the region is part of an unprecedented boom in major U.S. arms sales that has been presided over by the Obama administration, wrote William Hartung in Counterpunch. The majority of these arms sales have gone to the Middle East and Persian Gulf, with Saudi Arabia topping the list with over $49 billion in new agreements. This is particularly troubling, noted Hartung, given the complex array of conflicts raging throughout the region, and given the Saudi regime's use of U.S.-supplied weaponry in its military intervention in Yemen. The Obama administration has made arms sales a central tool of its foreign policy, he pointed out, in part as a way of exerting military influence without having to put boots on the ground in large numbers, as the Bush administration did in Iraq with disastrous consequences. The Obama administration's push for more Mideast arms sales has been a bonanza for U.S. weapons contractors, who have made increased exports a primary goal as Pentagon spending levels off. Not only do foreign sales boost profits, but they also help keep open production lines that would otherwise have to close due to declining orders from the Pentagon. For example, writes Hartung, earlier this year, Boeing concluded a deal to sell 40 F-18 fighter jets to Kuwait, which will extend the life of the program for another year or more beyond its current projected end date of early 2017. But it's not just about money. U.S. supplied arms are fueling conflict in the region. For Hartung, most troubling is a deal in the works that would supply 1 billion or more bombs and missiles for the Saudi Air Force for use in its war on Yemen. Moreover, what the Saudis may be getting for free in that war are the services of U.S. military intelligence, which selects targets among the Yemeni Houthi who overthrew a corrupt pro-Saudi government. Since Hartung wrote his article in late November, the Saudis have been accused of dropping U.S.-made cluster bombs in highly populated civilian areas in the capital of Sana'a, which under international law is a war crime. Despite the humanitarian catastrophe that has been occurring there, one that has been denounced by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and Doctors Without Borders, President Obama has yet to shed a single tear or express a word of regret for his and America's role in the Yemen tragedy. It's clear that there's a larger gun lobby than the NRA that has his ear and his support. I should also add that it has the support, apparently, of all the candidates for president, since none, including Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, has even mentioned the power of the military-industrial complex and the size of its budget, let alone denounce it. And speaking of Hillary, the release of the latest batch of her private emails contained a message from longtime U.S. diplomat Thomas Pickering, which, if nothing else, exposed as a fiction the notion advanced by Noam Chomsky, Phyllis Bennis, and others that the U.S. secretly supports Israel's continued occupation of Palestinian land. According to yesterday's English language Times of Israel, Pickering suggested on December 18th that Washington foment an Arab of December 18th, 2011, that Washington foment Arab Spring-style Palestinian protests as a method of pushing the Israeli leadership into making moves. Pickering, a former U.S. ambassador to Israel, who also served as Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs under former President Bill Clinton, emailed Clinton a recommendation to spark Palestinian demonstrations led by female protesters to push Jerusalem into talks. Upon receiving the message, Clinton asked an aide to print it out. Without detailing how the U.S. would spark these protests, Pickering noted that the U.S. could not be seen to have had a hand in fomenting the rallies, instead suggesting that Washington employ non-governmental groups and third parties to, quote-unquote, help. On the Palestinian side, he wrote, the male culture is to use force. Palestinian men will not for long patiently demonstrate that they will be inclined over time and much too soon to be frustrated and use force. Their male culture comes close to requiring its Pickering. The demonstrations within Israel proper, he insisted, must also be driven exclusively by women. If, quote, if the Palestinians see men engaged, they will jump in and the soldiers of the IDF will sooner or later use force, he wrote. This comes from several former senior Israeli military officers I have spoken with, he said. The officers are soldiers are fearful, nervous, outnumbered, insecure, and brought up on a severe distrust of Palestinian males, whom almost all of them have never spoken to except at roadblocks. End quote. Pickering said that the Palestinian leadership was willing to go along with the idea, and the use of females could, quote unquote, counteract fears that protests could get out of hand and endanger Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, his rule in Ramallah. They must develop growth and momentum just like Tahrir Square and attract more women to participate and thus gain world attention, Pickering wrote. Their leadership has shied away from this idea because they can't control it. They too are afraid of being replaced by a Tahrir Square-style action, end quote. Citing a need to see, quote, a game changer in the region, Pickering described Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as the impediment to reaching a two-state accommodation. Netanyahu is not going to move for anything that the Palestinians could offer him, which they can deliver, he wrote. He cannot deliver anything the Palestinians can accept or help. He is much more satisfied with the status quo than with the risks of change, end quote. What will change the situation is a major effort to use nonviolent protests and demonstrations to put peace back in the center of people's aspirations as well as their thoughts, Pickering added, and use that to influence the political leadership. That is far from a sure thing, but far, in my humble view, from hopeless, end quote. Well, that's from an email from former top State Department diplomat Thomas Pickering to then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on December 18, 2011. It only dispels the notion, not only dispels the notion, as I mentioned before, that the U.S. supports continuing Israeli occupation of the West Bank, but also raises questions of what role the U.S. played behind the scenes in the Egyptian uprising in Tahrir Square. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.